Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly libertarian podcast from the magazine with a longer shelf life than Mike Pence's presidential campaign. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy Halloween Eve, ghoulies.
Halloween howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Catherine, quick vote on who has had the best Reason costume this season.
Going to give, we had our Halloween party at the office last week. We did give official prizes, but we did not allow Reason staffers.
Participation trophies, if we may.
No, it was a real prize. It was a little guest certificate, but we didn't let Reason staffers compete for obvious reasons. Our director of development, Jackie, was dressed as a very specific 80s toy, which was the bust of a Barbie doll, like just the head and shoulders of a Barbie doll whose hair you could style. And it came with like makeup and curlers. I had this toy. Everyone had this toy if you were my age. Woman of my age at this party was like, and everyone else was like, what are you? What's happening right now? So that to me is always the perfect costume. You want to have insiders and outsiders on the costume. Barbie hairstyle head for the win.
Way to go, Jackie. All right. There are actual, alas, scary things afoot all over the world in connection with the now 24-day-old war in Gaza that began when Hamas terrorists surprise massacred 1,400 mostly civilian Israelis and kidnapped more than 200 others. These numbers also obviously include Americans and other nationalities. Israel, which has been bombing northern Gaza ever since, launched phase two of its counteroffensive over the weekend, with ground troops getting several miles in, as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warns of a long war to displace Hamas and dismantle its ability to make war. United Nations is warning of civil disorder and a looming humanitarian catastrophe on the Strip, including at Gaza's second largest hospital, which is said to be sheltering thousands and which Israel sent warnings on Sunday to evacuate. On Israel's northern front, there has been an increase in rocket attacks to and fro southern Lebanon, which is controlled by Hezbollah, which in turn is a client of Iran, whose president, Ebrahim Raisi, said Sunday that Israel has, quote, crossed the red line and that it may force everyone to take action. The White House does not like that noise, with the NSC's John Kirby saying today, quote, we're certainly going to act if we have to continue to protect our troops and our facilities. We have proven that we will strike and act to do that. And that's a strong message that Iran needs to take away. End quote. Well, at least there aren't pogroms breaking out. Oh, wait. Last night in Dagestan, a Muslim-majority area of Russia, rioters greeted an incoming flight from Tel Aviv by storming the airport in tarmac, more peacefully, but with sporadic affirmations of anti-Israeli and occasionally anti-Semitic violence. There were large pro-Palestinian demonstrations all over the world over the weekend, including London, Paris, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and elsewhere. American college campuses, meanwhile, are increasingly fraught places, with Jewish students at Cornell University terrified by a slew of online threats, unclear if they came from the campus at all, and professors everywhere attempting to break the Guinness Book of World Records for the most idiotic open letters on a single political topic. My favorite was a Columbia University, and my dad went to graduate school there, faculty missive featuring this amazing formulation, quote, one could regard the events of October 7th as just one salvo in an ongoing war between an occupying state and the people it occupies, or as an occupied people exercising a right to resist violent and illegal occupation, end quote, one could. So many things to be upset about, so little time to express our anxieties on a weekly podcast. So let's go around the table and pluck out one aspect each that has us feeling uncomfortable. Nick, why don't you lead us off?
I caught the tail end of a call for a ceasefire that took place in Grand Central Station in New York City on Friday. And I am moved to frustration by calls for an immediate unconditional ceasefire after Hamas, which is the governing authority in Gaza, you know, invades a country and slaughters a bunch of innocent people to say, okay, now is the time for a ceasefire, strikes me as imbecilic and just repugnant on an incredible level. And it shows the confusion, I think, that has cut through a lot of American institutions of higher learning and media, where there is an equation, and you can see the language when they start talking about occupying and decolonizing and whatnot, to justify absolute, you know, murder and grotesque barbarity against civilians, and to equate, you know, to wave that away in any such way. We saw this a bit after 9/11 in the U.S. when people like Ward Churchill talked about the little Eichmanns in the World Trade Center, that somehow you are complicit in any kind of system of oppression if you exist in a particular time and place. That's fundamentally fucked up thinking. And it leads to a lot of the intellectually, politically, and just humane, humanistic confusion going on right now. What worries me going forward as the invasion of Gaza goes, you know, proceeds apace, Israel, I think, has the, you know, it has the support of the world. People understand that you cannot live next to a governing neighbor where the, you know, where the government says, you do not have a right to exist. You do not have a right to be there. Our whole function is to eradicate you and your government. Israel has the support of the world in this, but they need to very clearly articulate what their success will be, you know, what they are trying to do and how they accomplish it. And they need to continually document the fact that they are not acting in the same way as Hamas, which will not be difficult for them to do because they are a trained army and not a bunch of terroristic thugs.
One thing that strikes me about the ceasefire discourse, and to be clear, I am in favor of a ceasefire, Nick Gillespie. But I also mean that to include that Gaza should cease holding 200 plus hostages. That's part of it, as is they should cease firing rockets into Israel every damn day, which they've been doing for a very long time. Catherine, what is making you feel uncomfortable?
I think that's a weird frame, by the way. Like, why are we doing our feelings today? But that's all right.
You know what? Because this is, I'll tell you why, Catherine. I'm glad you asked that question.
What feelings?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's true.
Catherine doesn't have feelings.
Robot doesn't have feelings. I get it. No, however, there's a lot of different things to have a sense of unease at in this world, Catherine. A lot of people are feeling a sense of unease. I want to connect with them emotionally and viscerally as we go through this public policy.
And also, if I might add, I said like Israel's, you know, point is that they have to articulate a policy that they will stick to and that will limit their feelings because, you know, as we see more and more video and footage and claims, some, you know, many of which have not been backed up, that are going to inflame the situation in terms of absolute grotesque barbarity. You know, Israel needs to do what it has to restrain itself from acting in kind. So, you know, that's not about feelings, but like if you ignore the feelings that give rise to this type of violence or war situations, I don't really see how you're going to successfully contain it.
Yes. Catherine?
So obviously one reason that I push you back is because like I do have feelings about this and they do make me uncomfortable. So I watched a bunch of the footage of the Dagestan airport situation. And, you know, at this point I have this reflexive response to this type of thing, which is I have no confidence that the way that these things are being reported is the reality, right? So what I know is like people with Palestinian flags went into that airport yelling. That's what I can see on the video. And then, you know, the headline is they were seeking out people with Israeli passports to do something bad to them. We don't know. I actually think that like from what I can tell after reading around, that is basically what was happening. This was an angry mob seeking a specific population of Israeli refugees whom they believed did not have a right to be in their country and who they were going to forcibly eject or worse. But I sort of my like meta examination of this or like my response to myself, just the idea that I cannot trust the New York Times headline on this at all is a real bummer. Like, it shouldn't be that I need to go scrounge around in the video. It shouldn't be that I need to look at each of these individual atrocities to see if the baseline coverage is accurate. I'm happy to do it because it's my job. But I think other people are experiencing this in a way that is not great. They shouldn't have to do it themselves. The same is true, of course, with these reports of the baby found in the oven. Same thing. It's like, I want to not believe that that happened. I want to not believe that there are pogroms. I want to not believe that people are putting babies in ovens. That is my baseline assumption, is that humans mostly don't do that stuff, but sometimes they do. And it looks like this time in the airport, that is in fact what was happening. And I think that the more we gaze upon this type of incredibly bad behavior, the more that people will feel justified in copying it or repeating it. And so I think that that's a real problem is... you know, we've seen this with the posters of about the kidnapped Israelis. You know, there's all these videos of people tearing down these posters. I have to believe that there would not be a large number of people tearing down these posters, except for the fact that some people tearing down the posters got a lot of publicity, and people who want publicity are now tearing down more posters. So there is this real problem of...
And one of those videos appears to show a confrontation between a poster terror downer and some other New Yorkers, and the person tearing down the posters says he doesn't believe that there are actually hostages.
Right.
At all.
And so there's just, you know, there's this recursive kind of, it's very hard to know what's true. It's very hard to trust sources that are otherwise sort of baseline trustworthy. And if we gaze over and over at humanity's bad behavior, I think it is going to make humanity behave worse.
That's a weird, terrible loop.
Yeah, I don't understand what the alternative is. And, you know, the baby in the oven story has not been documented by anybody. So it's like we hold that in bay. But this comes down to the question about, like, oh, were the babies, all of them decapitated or just some of them, but they're all dead. And I think that bigger image or that bigger truth, which is certified, you know, is like the one that we focus on. And that's going to, you know, that demands some kind of response.
Oh, absolutely. But I think we're not doing a good job of keeping that perspective. Like, I think what you just said is right. And I think that we're spending like tremendous amounts of time on who's tearing down which poster and should we all go tear down more posters or fight the people tearing down the posters. It's hard to keep perspective on the really big stuff.
But isn't that in some ways what we argue for here at Reason, which is that the way we determine truth is that we keep arguing about it. Somebody says one thing, another person says another thing, and people submit their evidence and it just gets worked out in the court of public opinion or Twitter or whatever.
The marketplace kind of ideas, something like that.
Right. I'm happy for that to
whatever
be our job,
is,
but I think it's...
And it's ugly, right? Like, and this is actually a thing we should acknowledge at times, is that it's not an easy process. But the alternative to just have a centralized authority determine this is what's true, that works much less well. And so as unpleasant as this is, and I certainly don't enjoy tracking down or trying to verify these stories or trying to even just like reading the Times and the Post coverage and deciding whether I think this is perfectly accurate or probably mostly accurate or something else, it's not something that I find particularly pleasing in my soul. It's not an hour I want to spend each day, but it is part of the job of being a journalist. And it's also, in fact, the way that we get from not knowing anything to knowing things a little bit better.
The journalist Dave Zweig, Z-W-E-I-G, had a pretty interesting Substack post a few days ago trying to track down the source of the 500 people died in the hospital, originally attributed to an Israeli strike. Still a lot of people in the Arab world believe that, but it's a lot of people have presented evidence to the contrary. He was just trying to see where that number was sourced to originally. And it's a pretty fascinating exercise, sort of like going over where did it first appear in the news. And then he also interviewed or queried, all the news organizations and journalists who ran with the number, just like sourcing it to the Gaza Health Ministry usually. And according to his reporting, it ended up coming out of an Al Jazeera English translated tweet. And his idea was, or conclusion was, that it was mistranslated. The 500 was not deaths, it was victims, which he got a couple of different people to do. But then it sort of the overall post is, how to read these kind of quotes, what you should be looking for in the sourcing, and is sort of illuminating, regardless of ultimately that even individual question. As you're a consumer of news and you see attributions, how to follow in attributions is it's a very interesting exercise. Peter, I didn't elicit from you, let's say, not your feelings, because and frankly, who cares? But what are you worried about in the in the panoply of bad and fraught news out there?
Well, when you introduced this topic, you mentioned John Kirby of the NSC threatening to strike back at Iran should Iran escalate here against the United States. We've seen a bunch of that. It's not just John Kirby. It's Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who also issued a warning to Iran that the U.S. would act swiftly and decisively if attacked here, right? And the U.S. saber-rattling in the region is designed to get Iran to back down. And it is, I think, intended, at least, hopefully, to prevent a wider war, which is what we want. But it might well have the opposite effect, because when you threaten a response, you threaten escalation, presumably a military kind of response, you commit yourself. Alternatively, you look foolish, like your commitments don't matter if the Iran crosses the line or does the thing that you said you would respond to, and then you don't respond, right? But you combine all of this with, you know, Janet Yellen saying we can absolutely afford another war, with just the Biden administration's general posture of, in fact, we are going to fight the good fight here if it comes to us, and we're going to respond. And I get a bunch of this, because I do think that the Biden administration's goal is not to fight a big war here, that they don't seem to be itching for a fight. At the same time, this posture of aggression, which is intended to project confidence and strength, it puts everyone more on edge, and it risks involving the U.S. much more deeply in an escalating conflict in which the U.S. is already a significant player.
Are you guys aware of the internet phenomenon of girl math? Have you heard about this?
Is that the Barbie thing?
Do tell.
No. I think it started out on some kind of like, I don't know, Australian or New Zealand podcast or something. But it's these two lady radio hosts, and people call in and they say, like, I want to buy this expensive pair of boots. Can you help me rationalize this purchase? And then they're like, well, if you wear the boots 10 times, then like the per wear cost is, and then like if you don't buy the boots, you'll buy two other pairs of shoes. So like they're basically free, right? It's like,
so you know, reverse Susie Orman, like where they're justifying purchases you can't afford.
Exactly. And it's like riffing on, you know, ladies be like, I want to buy shoes or whatever.
This is exactly how I rationalize my whiskey purchases.
Yes. So boy math is now the second order of this internet phenomenon, and it does involve the rationalizing of whiskey purchases. Janet Yellen is doing girl math on the war, is what I want to say.
Wow.
She's like, in a way, can we afford to not have a two military engagements around the world?
She heard boots on the ground and she was like, yes, I'll buy an extra pair.
As long as U.S. Army wears them a lot, you know,
she misunderstood. Like, well, like the per wear of boots on the ground is so low when you think about it. If we do more wars, you know,
To follow up on what Peter was saying, I am deeply, deeply worried that a lot of the voices who were all in on the invasion of Iraq, which we must look at as separate from, you know, the invasion of Afghanistan and then the stupid decision to occupy a nation build there. But the war in Iraq are really turning the same dials that they were 20 years ago. And you see it again and again where it's like, we have to be in Ukraine. We have to be in the Middle East. And if we don't, you know, if we don't fight in Ukraine and if we don't fight in Israel, even if they're not asking for our help, then we're going to be fighting in Taiwan. And it is, you know, it's deeply disturbing in real time to see the same rhetoric from many of the same people. The Atlantic is one of the main outlets of what, you know, I think could charitably and accurately be called like the deep state, where they're turning all of the knobs to say, every fight everywhere is part of, you know, some axis of evil, and you got to get all the spokes as well as the hubs and everything all together. And literally David Frum, you know, who, you know, was very complicit in, you know, George Bush's absolutely failed foreign policy, wrote something in the Atlantic to go back to girl math. It was like, can we afford, another war? We can't afford not to fight.
Not to, yeah.
That is the signature move of girl math is, can we afford it? We can't afford not to. I think the Iraq war comparison is pretty apt, and like to kind of go back to what I was saying earlier about how it's sort of frustrating and horrifying to not be able to trust mainstream sources. Like, I'm old enough to remember yellow cake. Like, you remember when we had like everybody, all ducks in a row, everyone agreeing that, there was this evidence, the WMDs were there, we were going to find them. It was only a matter of time. I was to go ahead and get ahead of Matt's neocon slander at the Weekly Standard at the time. And a huge amount of effort went into kind of validating that thesis, which turned out to be false. Like, it was not like one of the major, major, major justifications for that war simply didn't pan out. And I think that was one of the initial moments, at least in my awareness, where you could see this kind of lining up behind a specific set of evidence that everyone agreed on that didn't actually pan out, that like just wasn't there in the end. And everyone kind of agreed and walked away. And the dissenting voices were often slandered as misinformation and anti-patriotic and anti-American. And it wasn't a good time. It was not a good moment for the media.
And Nick, if I may just follow up on what Catherine was saying, though, like, and that the yellow cake thing and various other WMD things are relatively simple, and they were like an unbelievably complex to figure out what was right and what was wrong. And then you have, I think particularly in the Middle East, you have the Palestinian narrative, which is distinct from the Hamas narrative and the Israeli narrative of, the basic world in which they live are so radically and fundamentally different and deeply held. It's hard to know, when you're talking about media, which oftentimes is just duplicitous, but also most of the time doesn't really know, or things, the reality itself is really difficult to grasp. It multiplies all of the vagueness and the ambivalence, a thousandfold. So, it really gets difficult to, figure out what is true and what is real, on a massive, massive level.
Yeah. And again, it's our job to do it. Like, we're going to do it. We're going to try to figure out the truth. We're going to write about it. It's going to make people mad sometimes. But, sometimes our politicians are not so scrupulous with their pursuit of the truth. And they're the ones that ultimately end up sending the cash and the guns and everything else into our two-front war that we can not afford not to do.
Because we need a three-front war, really, because all you hear now is, we're not even paying attention to China. And China is about to launch a massive war somewhere, right?
I've been reading the Romney book by McKay Coppins, and when Mitt Romney would meet with Trump, who of course he hated, except he would meet with him and wanted to be Secretary of State, they could bond over how much they realized that China was the big threat. This forever China and forever threats. I'm going to include as my thing, I wouldn't say I'm worried about, but irritated by, over the weekend, Turkish president and all around authoritarian rat bag Tayyip Erdogan, however you pronounce his damn name, convened a rally of hundreds of thousands of Turks, at which he flew Palestinian flags, declared Hamas to be freedom fighters, called Netanyahu a terrorist, and then said, quote, "The main culprit behind the massacre unfolding in Gaza is the West. I reiterate that Hamas is not a terrorist organization. You, Israel, are an occupier. You are an invader. Israel, we will declare you as a war criminal to the world," end quote. NATO ally, great job, heck of a job, bringing Turkey into NATO in 1974, whenever that happened. I'm still mad about it. I was 6 years old. I knew it was wrong then. And I know it's wrong now. Okay, let's shift before it gets too late, talking about all this stuff. Last week, the Commerce Department reported that economic growth last quarter surged like the troops to 4.9%, sizzling. This is at a time of near record low unemployment rate. And yet Americans stubbornly refuse to believe that it's morning in America, with Gallup showing only 20% of us think the economy is even good. 48% say it's poor. This is our periodic dive into what we have called the weird economy, TM, right? TM, that's how we do that. Peter, what's going on with this numerical disconnect?
I think it's almost entirely prices. Prices in combination with wages. So, sure, inflation has tempered somewhat since its peak in the summer of 2021. It's no longer rising 10% or 9% or something like that year over year. That is true. But it's rising faster than it was 5 years ago. And even if it totally stopped, even if we had no inflation for 6 months, prices would still be so much higher than they were 3 or 4 years ago in a way that is simply noticeable to every consumer. And I think, I think part of the inflation story is not just the speed of the rise and the unusualness after a period of very low inflation. It's that it has specifically affected stuff that just about everyone uses all the time. Meat in particular, eggs, although egg prices have come back down, and gasoline. To make a broader political point about this, this is a big issue for Republicans. And it's a big issue for Republicans because we can talk about how the Republican conference and sort of Republican Party politics has become a cult of Trump, and they've spent the last 10 years not really knowing what they want policy-wise. But one thing that Republican voters in particular, and kind of independents who may be possibly swayed to voting Republicans, one thing they really want is cheap gas. This is actually a big deal for them. And so this is a big problem for the Biden administration, because the Biden administration keeps on not providing cheap gas. Other stuff is much more expensive, and people are just not going to be happy with that, no matter how many stats you sort of supply about how great the economy is relative to some other period of time.
Catherine, what's a thing that you worry about? Let's get to your worries and feelings. Or what do you think about sure. the near future of the economy?
I believe, Matt, that children are our future.
Okay.
And
that's why you're worried.
Even yours? Yeah.
That's why I'm worried. No, they're worried. So actually, when Peter was talking, I just remembered this weekend, and God forgive me for this, I busted out the CPI inflation price calculator to explain something to my son. Because he's obsessed with gaming consoles because he's a 10-year-old boy. And
some of us are still obsessed with gaming consoles.
I mean, I'm not,
despite no longer being 10-year-old boys.
I am not going to name names, but a Reason staffer came over to my house this weekend, not to hang out with me, just to play video games with my son.
It was not me.
I'm not naming names, but he watches all these videos about the evolution of the Nintendo company and the Nintendo consoles and whatever. And he could not understand the prices in these videos. Like, he was like, I don't get what's going on. So we had to do Moore's Law and inflation.
Wow.
Like, real quick in my house, because he was getting so agitated by the idea that how come everyone used to just be able to so easily buy their Nintendos for so cheap and now they're so expensive? And I was like, well, yes and no. But he has this visceral sense of money used to do more things than it does now. And he is not alone in that in America. And that's worrying, right? You don't want people generally to have a sense that particular type of sense of uncertainty about the future historically generates political unrest and other negative secondary consequences just over and above the straight economic ones.
We had the inflation talk over dinner last night in our house. This is
oh my God. Have you talked to your children about inflation?
Are you warming them up for a shitty Christmas, Matt? That was what my parents used to do in the 70s. It's like, hey, you know what?
It was in connection with the price of tickets for the Taylor Swift movie, which my 8-year-old saw. And she was wondering why she wasn't able to go to the actual concert. And so there's the price differential. But I came to find out that because she went, I didn't go, but that the Taylor Swift's charging $20 for the movie ticket price.
No, she is not charging $20.
Oh,
she is charging $19.89 because 1989 is a big, it's the year she was born. It's the name of one of her albums. It's a big, it's like it's a big number in her mythos.
It's not just girl math. It's girl numerology. It's right? girl so, Kabbalah.
So like. Because she arranged this deal very specifically with AMC, cut out the studios as the middlemen for distribution, she was able to charge a different price at every single theater than they normally would have charged, and also control the times of showing. So there, for example, you cannot go see the Taylor Swift movie on a Tuesday night.
Thank you for the boy math splaining from Suderman here. what I pointed out to my... My kid is that in our day, $20 was the $19.89 was the price of an actual concert ticket. And then that led to some festive. We didn't bring out
four if you were seeing Fugazi.
Break out the
famously
West Egg.
Limited their ticket prices to $5.
Pie hole,
you can't
beardy.
Stop him. You can't stop him.
All right. Nick, say something about the economy before we transition.
I think there's two things going on. One is that the discourse about the economy is totally way off. When you look at the work done by people like Scott Winship, and you look at after tax and transfers, people are actually doing quite well over the, you know, in the over the past 30 years or the past 50 years, the exact time period that the declinists say everything went to shit. We don't talk about things realistically. You know, it's like college. Nobody can afford college, yet people keep going to college. Nobody can afford houses, but millennials have caught up to Gen X and boomers at the same age of house ownership and things like that. I think that's part of it. I think the other big part is we are going through a structural change in the economy that is significant. I mean, this helps explain why so many men are out of the workforce, et cetera. The problem with Biden, and this was also true under Trump, because people didn't think the country was going in a good direction under him either, is these guys do not inspire any confidence that they're going to be around for the next 6 months, much less the next 6 years. We do not have a political class that can talk about a future in which things get better. They can only talk about a present where they're going to fix your, you know, they're going to put Band-Aids on every ache that you have, whether it is real or not. That's the problem. We are stuck in a presentism that is nostalgic looking backwards. And until we get somebody, you know, and it doesn't have to be an actual economic program. It can be a Reaganist type morning in America where somebody says, hey, you know what? We have a good future in front of us, and this is why, and kind of pulls people along realistically into a future that's going to be better than the present.
It reminds me, when you say that, Nick, of Trump's classic quote, which I won't quote verbatim, but he was talking about the massive deficit, which then was around $21.2 trillion. He's like, yeah, I'm not going to be around when we get the debt crisis.
Love it when they say the quiet part loud.
I mean, that is just the presentism writ large. And he, as a sort of political kind of calculation formula shower, that's all makes sense, was accurate. That is what the Republican Party in particular, and also that section of the Democratic Party that used to give lip service to the long-term financial picture being screwed, which it has been, and everyone knows this for a really long time, they just say, all right, that's going to be someone else's election. I'm not going to worry about it. And I think I suspect that contributes to at least a little bit of the broad population's distrust that even a quarter or year or multi-year economic boom is going to last. I think people are kind of smart enough to realize that there's a bad thing looming in the near future. And that we're whatever moment that we have right now is based on a binge. It's based on Janet Yellen's girl math and Donald Trump's girl math. Girl math all around. And I don't mean to malign girls in that way. And I'm sorry. And send your letters to Catherine Mangu Ward. All right. Please, reminder, please, to people to email your short queries to roundtable@reason.com. meaning letters from the week and such. Don't know why my brain short-circuited. That's not important right now. This one comes from Caleb Baxter, who writes, we libertarians proclaim, capital L, Caleb, you're going to need to watch that. We libertarians proclaim to be socially liberal, but I think we really ought to reevaluate where the Overton window is in the 2020s. Because of recent major wins for us, long-held libertarian beliefs such as marijuana legalization and gay marriage acceptance, just to name a couple, which were considered socially liberal positions 20 years ago, could be considered socially moderate today. Recent polls have shown that 88% of Americans support marijuana legalization and 71% of Americans support gay marriage. If not a majority, at least half of each major party's voters support both issues. So, has the Overton window really moved on top of us? Are we now the social moderates of the day? The cultural status quo, if you will. If not, where are we on the liberal outskirts of the Overton window right now? What positions do we hold that could be considered socially liberal in this day and age that both sides of the aisle have yet to catch up to us on? Catherine?
Sex work.
Yeah.
It's the sex work thing. That's what it is. Yeah. I mean, I have said this before, I think on this podcast, like I used to be a big fan and user of the formulation socially liberal, fiscally conservative, that I've stopped saying it because it don't make no sense now. Socially liberal means like we want a UBI and mandatory pronouns on everyone's face. And and fiscally conservative means, you know, whatever Donald Trump spent during his administration. So that's not a thing anymore. But I do still think there are places where libertarians can and should usefully pull liberals using their own reasoning and their own logic toward some places that they haven't gotten yet. And one is definitely sex work, which is best understood as a contract between adults. And we love those. We love us a contract between adults where both parties are informed and consenting. And I think that's not how you would sell it to the left. That's how you would sell it to the right. On the left, it's, hey, people should be able to do what they want with their bodies. And this is an argument that it has lurked on the edges for a long time. And I have some hope that it will kind of like break through to the mainstream of the American left.
Nick, you're a barefoot doctor of philosophy. Where are we out here on the perimeter?
I'm going to say that it's the radical restructuring of education and the hyper individualization of the educational experience, K through whatever, because libertarians are the only people who really are talking about allowing parents and students, especially as students get older, to tailor every aspect of their education the way that they want. The factory model of education or the agricultural model of education, whatever we want to call it, has such a thick hold on people. When you talk to even education reformers, they're still talking about, well, you know, you go to school in September, you get out in late May or early June, you know, you have vacations, et cetera, and you go to these centralized places. That has to end, and it will end, because, Matt, you know, as part of the libertarian moment, there's going to be a mass individualization and hyper-personalization of everything. And it is so radical to say that people are going to use money that is, you know, tax money at first. I think that'll change over time to educate themselves the way they see fit. That is something that should appeal to liberals because they all know that they've sat through horrible, you know, educational exercises that get them nowhere. And I think, you know, as they have kids, they also recognize that the best thing possible is actually letting kids follow their interests first and then develop expertise and that everybody gets the basics along the way. So I think it's going to be a radical de-evolution of education to the individual.
Peter, where are we out there sticking our necks out?
So I think the letter writer is correct that libertarians and conservatives in some ways have come around to some libertarian positions on social issues, in particular with regards to gay marriage and the legalization of marijuana, I think are probably the two most obvious examples. But just because they've come around to our position on specific issues, they have not, I think, fully grasped or fully adopted the underlying reasoning or the logic of our positions, which would expand, right? Like, which, if you sort of take it seriously, would expand far beyond gay marriage and, you know, and pot legalization. And that logic is, in many ways, what Catherine said. People should be able to do what they want with their own bodies, right? And that's, it's not like, oh, that all of these things that people want to do, they're great and wonderful. Maybe they are sometimes, right? Sure. It's just, no, you're your own person. You own yourself. You have a fundamental right to your body and to the way you present yourself in the world, to the activity that you, you know, that you engage in, to your conduct, as long as it is consensual, as long as it's in the private sphere. And obviously, we're mostly talking about adults here. There are different, I think, issues when it comes to children, especially very young children, right? But like, adults using private resources should be able to do what they want with their bodies. And that means stuff like heroin, right? That means sex work, right? That means drag shows, as long, you know, that are not publicly funded. Like, this is not, like, this is a, this is the world that libertarians want to live in. And it's not because we have decided that some of these specific use cases or specific political issues, oh, we've sided one way or the other. It's that we have a logic, a way of looking at the world that says, you know what, if people want to do it in private, by themselves, with other people, or, you know, with other people who are consenting, then go for it. That's okay. Maybe we even disagree with, like, with some of the specific practices personally, but the way we want to, the world we want to live in is a world in which people are free to make their own choices.
I don't know how I would exactly answer this question in English, which is a language that has escaped me in its use this morning, but I would say one part is actual dismantling and decontrol of stuff. Which kind of like synthesizes perhaps the previous three answers, which is to say that there are so many laws on the books that don't need to be there. They should just stop. There are so many government departments. We still are taking our shoes off at the airport. Immigration is like this absolute mess of country by country. And this little cap over here and this little process over here, a radical decontrol of government at all levels, at most levels, as the default, like sunset everything in terms of making laws of like, no, marijuana legalization doesn't mean that the government decides that enough minority-owned businesses are controlling the licenses that come to shut up. Just make it legal and shut up. Get the government out of it. Nick, shut up. I keep telling you. Impulse is gone in American policymaking for the most part. It is not part of the general conversation. It's actually coming up more and more in education, as Nick is pointing out, and that is to the good. It needs to go much further than that. But as a basic impulse, it was something that existed a lot more in the Carter Reagan era of deregulation of, hey, let's get rid of stuff. That doesn't make sense. And life will be better if we do. We need to do that. I need to think about the kind of the way that both prohibition as a concept, not just of substances, but of activities, is in almost every single case bad, and it creates this whole superstructure of laws. They just need to come down, all of them, really. That needs to be an impulse in American life in a way that it is not right now. And I'm glad that Nick is finding me humor.
I wish you had said this to your kids instead of taking it out on us. We agree with you, Matt. You know, just because you lost the Taylor Swift argument on Sunday night, don't take it out on us. That's all
I'm
saying.
That's true.
Not the first dad to lose a Taylor Swift argument with his daughters.
And the problem is, once you engage, you're finished. You know, it's a quagmire, Matt.
Unlike as previewed before on Slack, this is going to be a lightning round. So last week, after 3 weeks of tomfoolery, the majority GOP caucus in the House of Representatives, People's House, Nick, chose a new Speaker of the House, a guy you have definitely heard of before named Mike Johnson from Louisiana. Johnson is a four-term congressman representing the Shreveport area, 51 years young, big Christian conservative lawyer, and one of the more important figures in the House who helped support Donald Trump's legal challenges to the 2020 presidential election. Thanks, Mike. which Johnson then voted against certifying, as did basically everybody who had even a snowball's chance in Hades of getting the speakership. Peter, briefly, what does his victory in this whole 3-week exercise tell us about anything?
Well, I think it's concerning in one way, in that, as you said, he was not just a signer onto the plan to overturn the election results in 2020. He was somebody who led the gathering of signatures, led the effort to try and get false electors put in place and get Donald Trump put into the Oval Office when Donald Trump did not win the election. It is very concerning that someone like that is now third in line for the presidency. That said, a bunch of the stuff that Mike Johnson has focused on over the last few weeks as he has risen up the ladder to the speakership has been stuff that we have been talking about and saying is good. And in particular, he has focused on bringing the House and specifically back into regular order, which is the budget process called for by the 1974 Congressional Budget and Impoundment Act, right? Ding. And just getting a budget done on time. He has also said that we need a bipartisan debt commission. Now, bipartisan debt commissions are kind of inherently silly, right? Like, they're just like, oh, you know, we're going to get together and all hold hands and sing kumbaya, and maybe we'll say we need to raise taxes and, you know, cut entitlement spending 20 years from now. But guess what? If you don't have bipartisan buy-in to entitlement reform in particular, you're never going to get it. And so, in fact, all of the smartest people, all of the, I think, the sort of the most serious people on the debt reform beat all think that somehow or another you're going to have to create commitment from both parties, maybe not from every person in both parties, but from both parties. You're going to have leaders on both sides agree to do entitlement reform if it is going to stick. And so starting here and saying now, well, now is actually too late, but the best time to start was 10 years ago. Instead, we'll start tomorrow. That is actually the right way to go if you are going to try and do something serious to bring down the long-term debt.
Catherine, Mike Johnson, hot or not?
Always, you know, I would like a 1 to 10 scale, and even then, I'm going to refuse to answer. So,
I'd like that for my weight.
The Civility Caucus. He likes civility. As Peter already noted, he also likes probably overturning election results in favor of Donald Trump, and he really, really does not enjoy homosexuality. That seems to be a thing he's very not excited about. But
he's backed bringing back sodomy laws.
Yeah, that's I'm obviously
that's only to
in
intensify his own sexual pleasure. I'm convinced.
Comedic understatement. He is in a covenant marriage, which is a Louisiana specialty that like is basically a marriage that's even harder to divorce from. Dude loves straight marriage is what I'm saying. But he likes civility. So I guess if I'm looking for a bright side, was that our job here? I don't know. He proposed after establishing this civility caucus, he proposed legislation to designate a national day of civility. All right, sure. Let's be civil one day of the year. He chose July 12th. Oh, why July 12th, you ask? Oh, thank you. It's based on a Bible verse. It's Matthew 7:12, which is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So that journey, that particular journey of like the social conservatism hidden inside all the things he does, I think is one that we're going to be on as a nation in his speakership. And I don't think I personally am going to enjoy it.
Nick, any preliminary nicknames for Mike Johnson that you can think of?
Oh, you know.
Nope.
Mike's careful. Johnson. I don't know.
Nope. No, we just went right for it.
Johnson and Johnson.
What I like about him, and I'm prepared to be very disappointed, but he's kind of waved away a lot of the early calls for various social conservative stuff. So he does seem fixated on the budget and on actually passing budget bills. He talked about the Israel aid, which he's going to push for, which he supports, but that they're going to cut spending elsewhere to come up with $14 billion to give to Israel. He's questionable on Ukraine funding, which is fine, you know, but it's like he actually seems to be going first with budget stuff. So I think that's great. I dislike social conservatism in general, but I'm happy to live with it if, you know, they're not forcing it on other people. So good luck with that.
My favorite thing about Mike Johnson is that I had not heard of him before. He rose to the speaker candidacy ship, which speaks to my ignorance, of course, but also that he's not one of those irritating camera hogging backbenchers, or at least not successfully so, which is a very small Pyrrhic victory these days, given that Congress has all been sort of loading into the direction of pointless kind of publicity stunts and everything except actual legislation. Small beer. I don't see any real sense that the fundamental problems of a very thin and fractious GOP majority in the House that wants to shoot itself in the shins constantly. I don't see that going away anytime soon. And I suspect that we will see some, you know, rear guard Gates maneuver in the future. But in the meantime, it's, I guess, nice to have someone in the chair or not. Okay, let's get to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural sphere. Catherine, why don't you lead us off?
I am watching season two of Loki, the time heist-based trickster god Marvel series. I'm streaming it on Disney Plus, and I think there are five episodes now. I'm not quite to the fifth episode. But it's good in the way that the first season was good. I liked the first season a lot. I liked it enough that the entire Reason staff dressed up as Loki for Halloween.
Except for Stephanie Slade, who dressed up as Nick Fury.
Except for Stephanie Slade, who was Nick Fury, which is perfect. But
Matt, do you want to go back to DC anytime soon after hearing that?
Nope. But the assumption that the first season is very fresh in your mind is strong with the first episode of the second season. I spent a good minute having no idea what was going on, despite being something of a fan of the series. In general, my expectations for Marvel, I'm Peter Suderman now, have diminished somewhat. But this was still, it's still pretty solid so far. And I remain a fan of the lightly steampunky time heist Marvel thing because I was born in 1980 and that's who I am. Sorry.
You just like Tom Hiddleston.
And I love Tom Hiddleston. No apologies. Yes.
Is Owen Wilson still there?
He sure is. He's just Owen Wilsoning very, very hard in this series. His character is named Mobius M. Mobius, in case you were wondering. So that's what's going on with that show.
Unlike Mike Johnson, he's pretty easy to Google.
Yes.
Yes. Nick, why don't you Mobius us a cultural recommendation?
So I'm recommending two novels by Sandra Newman, whose three novels ago book, The Heavens, I also recommended here. Her new novel is called Julia, and it is a retelling of 1984 from the position of Julia, the woman that Winston Smith falls in love with. It is a just it's a tour de force of literary fiction. I mean, if you you know find 1984 and all of the kind of permutations of that interesting, this book will blow your mind. As importantly, or really more importantly, it captures something. You know, we were talking about this sense of doom and dread and failure and depletion. It captures so much of contemporary America in the context of the universe of Orwell's 1984. It's just absolutely stunning. Her work before that, which came out a year ago, The Men, takes place in a near future where suddenly all men disappear. And it was proactively and preemptively canceled as transphobic on Twitter by people who had could not have read the book. But again, what Newman does consistently is create these worlds that are filled with dread and fear and desperation, and then there are glimmers of hope. I realize this may not mean anything coming from me, but she, to my mind, is the most interesting and exciting novelist, literary novelist working today, because she captures a palpable sense of anger and fear and distortion in contemporary living, always in a kind of projected near future, and then offers ways both around it and to recognize that, you know, this is the world that we're stuck with. Just a phenomenal book, but I highly, highly recommend Julia. And I would say read that and then pick up The Men.
Peter, what have you been consuming?
I watched Anatomy of a Fall, the French legal thriller that won the top award at the Cannes Film Festival earlier this year. It's a movie about marriage and maybe about murder. And to repeat a theme from earlier in this podcast, it's also about how and whether we can really know anything at all. The core of the story is a murder trial. A writer, a woman, is accused of killing her husband, who has fallen out of the top floor of their French chalet. He's found it. He's sort of in the snow below. And so she goes on trial for this. And what we see in the trial is not necessarily like a perfect, sort of highly detailed legal procedural in the sense of you're going to learn the French legal system. Instead, what we get from this is two sides of a story, both sides are in some ways admittedly trying to interpret the evidence. So there's a really great, powerful scene in the middle of the trial in which first you see the prosecution present a blood spatter analysis of the blood stain that was found at the scene of the murder. And the blood spatter analyst for the prosecution says, "There is absolutely no way that this could have been caused by an accidental fall or by somebody throwing themselves out of the window." And then he presents a whole bunch of reasons for this, including a simulation and a video. And in this moment, you have been sort of pulled back and forth about whether she did it or not. You kind of don't know. But his total confidence sways the viewer and the courtroom to the side of, oh, well, obviously she must have done it. There's physical evidence. It shows you that she did it. And then the next scene, the next thing that happens is a different blood spatter analyst who makes an equally convincing case that it would have been nearly impossible for someone to kill him and produce this particular blood spatter. And they have fall tests using a crash test dummy that you can see on video, and they show how actually the body just bounced and produced this sort of particular. And it is just an absolutely fascinating look at how nearly all evidence, including up to our own memories, are the subject of interpretation inherently and inevitably. And you can never get away from narrative and from interpretation of the world around you, because it's always secondhand. Even in something that you saw yourself that you remember a week later or years later, it's still secondhand, right? Because your own memories can fail you and your own memories can trick you at times. And so it's just this kind of super fascinating, super well-paced, incredibly gripping thriller about the marriage of a couple that is quite complicated, about maybe somebody killing another person, but also about how it is that we know anything and how difficult that is.
I will recommend wholeheartedly what I think is the best comedy special that I've watched this year. Came out last month by Shane Gillis, called Beautiful Dogs on Netflix. If you don't know Shane Gillis, he's this sort of schlubby guy. Looks like baseball Sean Casey, Nick. Mm. And a good comp. Who was on, he's one of these people who is on the forefront of how comedy has just been reshaping over the last 5 years, the economics of it. He was hired on Saturday Night Live 4 years ago or so, and then unhired within 5 days because, you know, old podcasts had surfaced of him saying allegedly horrible things about the gays or the minorities and such. And he issued a half-hearted apology, which he eventually retracted. But then he went on and just did his own YouTube special that was huge. Recent thing, Beautiful Dogs. He's a guy who just sort of exists in a great cultural and political straddle. Between kind of, real America, TM again, the coasts, and between conservatism and liberalism. The special has some great gags about how, like, you know, if you're a dude in your 30s and you've started to read about World War II and watch documentaries, it's coming, brother. You're going to be a conservative. I can feel it inside of me. It's bubbling up. It does a lot of stuff like that. And there's a really great kind of set piece towards the end of it about him going to Mount Vernon, George Washington place, and with all these people in play acting and kind of or in costume and having these different thoughts about like George Washington's awesome, George Washington's a slave owner, what the, you know, and like the, and dealing with all of the dissonances from it. It's just very, very funny. He does a really good Trump impersonation, very casually. So talks too much about sex, don't want to hear that, and makes it uncomfortable. And he's just hilarious. He's becoming kind of the Dave Attell type person in a comic that the comedians themselves like a lot. So check it out. It came out last month on Netflix. Beautiful dogs.
Now I'm excited.
Jesus Christ. Okay. Let's thank you for listening to our taking the Lord's name in homage more than vain. And listening to everything that we do over at reason.com/podcasts, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum series with Gene Epstein. There's a new podcast, from what I understand here. Started rolling out a new show every Tuesday. It's called The Best of Reason Magazine, and we're using AI. So every Tuesday, you get to listen to a curated selection of some of the best writing from Reason, read aloud to you by a by a robot voice modeled off our very own editor-in-chief, Catherine Mangu Ward. Catherine, what the hell are you people doing?
I just think it's so cool. It's so cool. So we've just, you know, we've been, for a long time, people have been asking for audio versions of our articles. That used to be expensive and difficult. And now it is easy and cheap and fun. So we're starting with Robot Catherine reading you The Best of Reason, as the podcast name suggests, once a week. These are often kind of longer form pieces that you might just want to put on while you're doing the dishes. But I'm kind of busy, so I can't be out here reading the magazine to you. But luckily, Robot Catherine is available. She's not perfect. She sometimes puts the like emphasis on the wrong syllable, but it's like she's close. So for regular listeners to the roundtable, she sounds like Matt. For regular listeners to the roundtable, I would love your feedback on like Robot Catherine over there versus real Catherine over here, because I, you know, she Robot Catherine can always be improved and improving.
Does Robot Catherine have feelings?
No, she's perfect.
That is, she's a real boy. Does she have a nickname yet, or is she just Robot Catherine?
I think it's like KMW, but the M stands for machine.
Catherine ex machina Mangu Ward. Matt, were you doing
KMWAI?
Were you doing a pasta voice there?
I was doing Geppetto, man. I mean,
yeah, I know you were doing an Italian voice, Matt Welch. This is Shane Gillis. It got Shane Gillis into trouble.
I don't see nationality. I'm just you know, I'm recapitulating Disney, the great animator, Walt Disney.
The Conqueror Worm.
All right. I need to unplug my microphone. So thank you for listening, everyone. Have a fun and scantily dressed Halloween. And show us your pictures, or at least show Robot Catherine your pictures. And we'll get you next week. If you like what we do here at the Mothership of Reason, please go to reason.com/donate. And think about giving us a tax-deductible donation that allows us to do more things with artificial intelligence and Halloween costumes. That's it. We'll see you next week.
Girl math.